Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, this week marks the 70th anniversary of the ANZUS Treaty between Australia and the United States. It's a defence treaty. Since it was signed in 1951, our countries have banded together to fight wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. In a video posted to social media, US President Joe Biden said the relationship with Australia was as essential today as it was 70 years ago.
Today we mark a significant milestone in an alliance between the United States and Australia. 70 years ago, our countries came together to sign the ANZUS Treaty, creating an enduring partnership, quote, to strengthen the fabric of peace, end of quote, in the Indo-Pacific region. That partnership is as essential today as it ever has been in securing the safety and prosperity of both our countries. And on this anniversary, we reaffirm our commitment to advancing our shared values, democratic norms, global security, and the prosperity for the next 70 years and beyond. America will never forget the first and only time the Collective Defense Articles of ANZUS Treaty were formally invoked 20 years ago. It was September the 11th. Our Australian friends stood with us in that darkest hour, just as our two nations stood shoulder to shoulder in every major conflict since World War I. So Prime Minister Morrison and the people of Australia, thank you for your partnership and your friendship. God bless you all, and I look forward to continuing our work together for peace, prosperity, and freedom in the years ahead.
Yeah, the US President Joe Biden. Well, as he said, the ANZUS Treaty's only been used once in its entire history, when planes hit the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center on September the 11th in 2001. Prime Minister John Howard invoked the ANZUS Security Treaty to join the fight against al-Qaeda. Now, you'll remember he was actually in Washington on the day of the attack to celebrate the 50th anniversary of ANZUS with US President George Bush. Here's the former Prime Minister, Mr. Howard, talking about why he invoked the treaty.
It was a huge statement of friendship, of solidarity, of a shared determination. And it gave very public expression, something that many millions of Australians have always taken for granted, that when there's a scrap and a common cause, America and Australia will stand together.
Well, if it wasn't for COVID, our current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, would have been in the United States, marking the occasion on the South Lawn at the White House. But, of course, not to be. Instead, Scott Morrison lay a wreath at the Australian-American Memorial in Canberra. The alliance, or the friendship between our countries, has been on topic, so to speak, especially because of the collapse of matters in Afghanistan and the takeover of Kabul by the Taliban. Australia, of course, was with the United States in that military conflict that lasted 20 years, only, as we've seen in recent weeks, for the Taliban to reclaim Kabul in recent weeks. It's left many people thinking, well, what was the point of all that? And so tonight we're looking back at Australia's relationship with the United States and indeed looking forward. How will our alliance evolve over the next 50 years? Will it be as strong as ever? Is it still fit for purpose? Or as one of my next guests asks, do we need to reevaluate our relationship with the United States? Joining us tonight, Mark Beeson is Professor of International Politics at the University of Western Australia. Mark, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Phil. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you with us too. Alex Tuerman is a former advisor to former ambassador, former Australian ambassador to the United States, Joe Hockey. Alex, good evening to you from Washington in the United States, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Appreciate y'all.
Great to have you with us. We did invite Mr. Hockey onto the program. He was unfortunately unavailable. And joining us too is Emma Shortis, who's an historian and author of a new book called Our Exceptional Friend, Australia's Fatal Alliance with the United States. Dr. Emma Shortis, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Great to have all of you with us. Mark, can I start with you? ANZUS was signed in 1951. Give us a brief summary of what was happening in the world at that time geopolitically, and why was the it signed in the first place?
Well, the Second World War had not long since finished, and Australia, I think it's, to put it in a longer time frame, I think it's important to recognise that Australia's never been terribly confident about its place in the world, and particularly its relationship with Asia. And I think the near-run thing about Japan almost threatening to invade Australia during the Second World War really heightened some of those fears and concerns. And even before the war had finished, Curtin had switched allegiance from Great Britain to the United States virtually overnight. And he did this as a calculation of what he conceived to be Australia's strategic interest at the time. And that was the assumption that Australia was incapable of defending itself and therefore needed to cultivate what Bob Menzies famously called a great and powerful friend, a new one. So they immediately looked to solidify the relationship that had developed during the war with the United States in the form of a treaty. And the Americans, it has to be said, were somewhat reluctant to do this initially. And the deal was America was more concerned with reconstructing Japan, its former enemy, and making it a kind of pivot to hold back the expansion of supposed communist infiltration into Northeast Asia and the world generally. So Japan was consciously wanted to be built as a successful capitalist outpost in the Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union. And as far as the Americans were concerned, they weren't that keen on having a treaty, but they decided to do so basically to shut up Australia and its complaining about the soft treatment of Japan in the aftermath of the war. So it was in keeping with many of Australia's ideas about their place in the world. And it's understandable at that time, I think, that policymakers would have been very concerned to ensure that they had America's notional support. And we can talk about the actual detail of the relationship later. But it's in the context of the times, it's understandable. But as you mentioned, it's questionable about what the current status is now and what the future will be.
Mm. It was popular at the time, wasn't it? Because, I mean, Australia had just come out of the Second World War, and there was a tremendous sense of the precarious nature of Australia in the face of a significant threat like the Japanese posed, and that without the significant support of the American fleet in key battles like the Coral Sea, Midway Island and elsewhere, that Australia might have been in trouble. So in general, it was a popular move in Australia, at least, wasn't it?
Oh, indeed. And to be fair, the ANZUS alliance, if you take surveys of public opinion in Australia, a lot of people still feel that on the whole, it's an important thing and it's a valuable asset for Australia's security. A lot of people don't understand it that well and what it actually obliges the partners to do. But I think as a sort of symbolic expression of this strategic relationship between Australia and the United States, particularly in the context of this rapidly unfolding Cold War and the threat supposedly of the Soviet Union, I think it's quite understandable that many people thought it was an excellent idea for Australia.
In short, what does the ANZUS Treaty oblige either party to do? If Australia is attacked, does the United States automatically come to our aid and vice versa?
Famously, it doesn't oblige anybody to do anything other than just consult in the event of either party being threatened. So, for example, we weren't obliged to go to the aid of the Americans when September the 11th occurred. And in some ways, it's a slightly preposterous idea that Australia would go to the aid of the United States, the most powerful military force in the world in such circumstances. But again, the symbolic nature of that kind of gesture was what was most important. And I think, in my view, that's always been the case, that Australia's been very enthusiastic, or Australian policymakers have been very enthusiastic to demonstrate their kind of bona fides and to try to ensure that the United States might live up to its moral obligation if Australia found itself in security difficulties. But Australia is not obliged to, and it's worth pointing out that when John Howard actually asked the Americans to give Australia a hand in sorting out the Timor crisis a few years ago, the Americans turned them down flat because there was nothing in it for the Americans. It was more trouble than it was worth. And the influence of Australia over American policy thinking was pretty minimal.
Mm. All right. Emma Shortis, can we bring you in here? Your new book, Our Exceptional Friend, Australia's Fatal Alliance with the United States. In the book, you argue that ANZUS doesn't actually provide Australia with any kind of perpetual security guarantee. What's your view of what sort of protections the alliance offers us?
Well, look, you know, I certainly agree with Mark, you know, who was speaking about Article 4 of the ANZUS Treaty, which says that the parties will act to meet a common danger should that danger eventuate. And of course, a promise to act can mean, you know, absolutely anything. So there's no obligation on the part of the United States to come to Australia's rescue, you know, should we ever need it. And I think Mark's completely right when he suggests that the Americans would only ever really do that if it was in their interests. So it's certainly possible that the United States would come to our rescue, but it's certainly not inevitable. And you know, I argue in the book that part of what ANZUS does is, in fact, I guess, force Australian foreign policy into this position where we assume that there is that threat, that, you know, we are going to need American protection because, you know, since ANZUS was written 70 years ago, Australian governments have looked out into our region in particular and to the non-white countries in our region and seen existential military threat. And I think that ANZUS just really reinforces that attitude and informs Australian foreign and security policy in a way that I think is strategically quite dangerous. Mm.
Why? Given Australia's history and particularly its recent history with Japanese expansionism and its imperial ambitions, why shouldn't Australia be concerned about threats from the North or indeed anywhere else?
Well, look, I think Mark was right that in the aftermath of the Second World War and as ANZUS was signed, there is an atmosphere of real fear amongst white Australians because of Japan and because of the attacks on Northern Australia. But the historical evidence suggests that there wasn't actually a real threat of land invasion by the Japanese Imperial Army. And so the threat perception there, I think, is a little bit different to the historical reality, which is not to say, again, that those fears weren't real. But what ANZUS does, I think, is kind of make those fears almost immortal and enduring, so that ANZUS has created a situation where it almost needs an enemy, and it needs an enemy in our region. And several countries have had a turn in the 70 years since. You know, we've had Japan and then Indonesia had a go, and now ANZUS is almost completely reoriented towards China. You know, and that's not to minimize the significant moral and security issues with what the Chinese government is doing. But what it is to say is that ANZUS kind of predetermines us to see threat where there isn't necessarily as significant a threat as we are led to believe. And it also kind of predetermines then the way that we approach the region, which is not even to talk about yet the way that ANZUS has dragged us into other wars, where, you know, I think Australia had very little business being involved. And those
such as
Vietnam, such as Iraq, and such as Afghanistan, where we're seeing the consequences of that play out in very real time. Mm. And that's what historically ANZUS has done. It has taken us into American wars.
You say that in your book that Australia is in a sense a follower of the US into war, almost whatever the circumstances, no matter what the circumstances. Do you see that? That we're just an unquestioning lackey of the United States? So you seem to be suggesting that in your book. Is that how you see it?
Look, in a word, it is. But I think it's important to distinguish, you know, who we mean when we talk about Australians. My book argues that Australian governments are kind of predisposed to play that role with the United States, and they've been quite open about that. You know, listeners might remember in the kind of heyday of the Trump administration when Trump was tweeting at North Korea about nuclear, his big nuclear button. The Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, in the midst of all that, said that, you know, should Donald Trump go to war with a nuclear-armed North Korea, then Australia would join them because in security terms, and he said, we are joined at the hip. And we've seen that repeated time and time again, you know, senior Australian bureaucrats talking about the beating drums of war and the protection afforded us by ANZUS. And to me, you know, that is quite frightening when we're talking so cavalierly about following a president like Donald Trump, you know, into a nuclear war with North Korea. unquestioningly, that leads me to think that ANZUS doesn't make Australia or the world safer.
Well, I suppose the one thing you can say about Donald Trump is that he didn't start any new wars while he was president, which is would be a first, I think, for most American presidents since the war.
Jimmy Carter.
Exactly. All right. Let's bring in Alex Tillman here, former advisor to former Australian ambassador to the United States, Joe Hockey. Alex, welcome back. What do the Americans think? What do Americans think about the ANZUS Treaty, if they think anything at all? I suspect it's something that we talk about at this end of the equation, but in America is probably would barely mention, barely rate a mention. Is that fair?
Well, Phil, I can say that, you know, within Washington, the ANZUS Treaty is alive and well. When we talk about Australia and the U.S. fighting side by side in every major conflict since World War One, that resonates with the American people and with influencers and stakeholders in Washington. One thing I just want to zoom out with in regards to the ANZUS Treaty. Yes, we are celebrating the 70th anniversary. Yes, Australia has been side by side with the U.S. in every major conflict. But the depth and breadth of the U.S.-Australian bilateral relationship is so deep. When you look at it from an economic perspective, when you look at it from a cultural perspective, be it in sport, art, or through our mutual expansionist histories, you know, it's really important. But if you move back to the ANZUS Treaty in and of itself, I think there was a poll released in July of this year that said that about 85% of Australians believe that it is likely that the U.S. would assist Australia in the face of the next significant threat. Now, Australia is facing a lot of major threats that are actually a lot of threats that the U.S. is facing currently. COVID-19, it is ravaging the United States more so than it has Australia. Australia is obviously grappling with its own epidemic within its country, but China's growing power is a major concern with many Australians. Climate change, it's something that we're dealing with. We just had a major hurricane come through the U.S. In the past week, and there's flooding from Louisiana up to New York. You know, there with all of these things, there are potentially severe economic downturns. And, you know, these are major concerns. But the good thing is that the U.S. is working hand in hand with Australia on all of these issues. We saw it with the cyber attack on Australian universities, public organizations and corporations, following Prime Minister Morrison's request for a investigation into the origins of COVID. And the U.S. actually came to aid Australia in 2020 to help them with the Cyber Capabilities Project training agreement. So, you know, this relationship is deep. It is diverse. And you can see that not only through the $1.25 trillion economic foreign direct investment relationship, but you can see it with the 32 military the military personnel that Australia has in 32 U.S. states.
If in a bold sense, if Australia came under military attack from a foe, would America come to its aid? A lot of people suggest that it wouldn't.
I strongly believe that the U.S. would come to Australia's aid if there was a kinetic threat on the Australian homeland. And I mean, I just move back, 75 years to Papua New Guinea. And I would argue that there was a true threat to the Australian homeland. And the U.S. was shoulder to shoulder with Australian troops in those dense jungles.
Yeah, Alex, you say that there was no plan by the Japanese to invade Australia, and historically that's probably right. There's argument about it. Probably that's right strategically, that the Japanese hadn't thought about a conquest of Australia as such. But they certainly bombed extensively the northern part of Australia. I mean, there was incredibly hostile activity on Australian soil here. It's not as though Australia is immune from threat, is it? Emma?
No, of course not. And I, again, that's not to. I certainly wouldn't seek to minimise the incredible fear during the Second World War. What I would suggest is that, you know, Mark was talking about the history of ANZUS and why the Americans agreed to it when they were you know, pretty reluctant really to give Australia this security treaty. Part of the reason that Australia got that was because we were being so stubborn about signing a peace treaty with Japan. You know, the Australian government was reluctant to engage in reconstructing a relationship and reconstructing the region. And what I argue in the book is that in the 1950s, the Australian government looked out into our region with fear and sought that, you know, outside white protector rather than looking to the region and seeking out ways to engage constructively and to build relationships, deep economic and cultural relationships, which would mean that, you know, we wouldn't feel like we were threatened or that there was this continual military threat. And I think we can't, you know, what we haven't really spoken about yet is how deeply tied that is to racism and to white Australia, to the white Australia policy. You know, I argue in the book that one of, if not the biggest reason that white Australian governments look out into our region and to non-white people and non-white countries with fear is because they're so deeply conscious that we are living on stolen land. And I think that I suppose shared historic experience between the United States and Australia is really critical to understanding ANZUS and the so-called shared values of that treaty.
Mm. Mark, what's your view of the way the alliance has been? Do you think it's made us into an unquestioning lackey of the United States?
Well, I think there's always been an overwhelming willingness on the part of all political leaders in Australia to sort of pay the insurance dividend. Mm. And that basically means signing up to whatever foreign adventure the United States has got itself involved in. And the point to make about this, I think, is that, and this applies to whether or not America would come to our aid in the event of a crisis, it would be decided entirely on the basis of what's in the United States' national interest. Mm. So they will either support us or not support us because it makes sense for them to do so. And their current concern in this part of the world is with China. So once again, Australia and a couple of other countries, Japan and possibly even India, might be useful allies in an attempt by the United States to contain or constrain Chinese development and assertion. And to be fair, there are reasons for being concerned about China's behavior, but there's a question about what's the most useful or appropriate way for a country like Australia to act in those circumstances. And I would argue, for what it's worth, that there are more creative things for a so-called middle power like Australia to actually do in these kinds of circumstances than just go in lockstep with whatever they decide in Washington is most appropriate to suit America's national interests. So the idea that we might actually have a different set of interests in Australia because of who we are, where we are, and our particular history never seems to enter the minds of policymakers in Australia, or not until they've left office, at least. And Malcolm Fraser is perhaps the most celebrated example of somebody who completely changed his mind about the value of the alliance relationship with the United States after he ceased to become prime minister. And he wrote a withering critique of the alliance and its impact on Australia, which is well worth reading. But he didn't do that until he left office. And that is true for nearly every prime minister of recent times. They've all sort of become more thoughtful about their understanding of the alliance and its impact on Australia than they ever were when they were actually in power. And that's one of the problems, I think, because when they all go off to the Osmin talks in Washington and get schmoozed by their counterparts in the United States, I think it really produces a sort of cultural mind shift in many of the policymakers and the Australian strategic elites. And that's, in my view, part of the problem and part of the reason for being locked into a particular way of thinking about the value of the relationship.
Mm. The strategic interest of Australia is aligned with the United States, is it not, Alex Tuman, in acting as some sort of constraint on the rise and expansionism of China in the South China Sea and elsewhere? Do you think in that sense the US would see Australia as aligned with its interests, wouldn't it?
100%. And I think Mark touched on this as well in referencing India and Japan. But, you know, the Quad is going to increasingly become an extremely important alliance network throughout the world, but specifically within the Indo-Pacific. And it is working constantly on joint military exercises, as well as sharing of intelligence and data. to ensure that not only Japan, India, and the U.S. are protected, but also Australia. The goals between Australia and the U.S. and the Indo-Pacific are aligned in my mind because they are undergirded by a value system that believes in free speech, that believes in the right for self-determination, and that believes in the freedom of press. And we're seeing some of our adversaries attack all three of those areas, whether it's in Hong Kong or whether it's human rights with Uyghurs. So I think the interests are aligned throughout the world, but specifically within the Indo-Pacific between Australia and the U.S. But Emma touches on a really good point, though. It is a very nuanced world. I mean, you can't look at every issue as being adversarial by any means. We have to cooperate with China on some aspects, whether that's, you know, confronting them when it comes to human rights violations, but also potentially cooperating with them when it comes to things like climate change, because we have to face the fact that China is the largest global emitter of greenhouse gases. U.S. comes in number two, and it's an issue that's impacting all of us. You see it with the Australian wildfires and the Californian wildfires and the weather events that we're seeing across both countries.
Mm. Emma, what do you? What's your view of this? Because surely Alex is right, isn't he, when he says that we need to act in concert with allies in relation to the values which, under Xi Jinping at least, China appears to be attacking, values of independence, of free speech, of the rights of minors, political freedom, and so on and so forth, that Australia is rightly aligned here, and therefore that's a proper place for us, isn't it? How do you see it?
Look, I mean, I think it's certainly vitally important for us to take a moral approach to those questions of what the Chinese government is doing, you know, in the South China Sea, in Hong Kong, and so forth. You know, I think that's vitally important. I think Australia has been very inconsistent in its approach to those issues. And, you know, I think, again, that question of values for me is a pretty dicey one, because we talk so much about these shared values that we have within the United States, always in opposition to China and the values of China. But our shared values with the United States, you know, span the values of the Trump administration and the values of the Biden administration. And I think that should raise some really serious questions for Australians, because so often we talk about these, I suppose, moral issues as if our shared values with the United States are pure and kind of unquestionable, and also completely opposed to Chinese values. And
well, they are at the moment, aren't they? I mean, it's what are we seeing at with Xi Jinping's China? It wasn't necessarily the case with the China 20 years ago, but under Xi Jinping's China, there is an all-out attack on values which we would hold quite dear, such as freedom of association, political freedoms, and freedom of speech. I mean, these are significant issues for us in the region, aren't they?
They're very significant issues, I think. And again, you know, I'm not seeking to minimise that at all. I think what happens in Australia and in Australian conversations about China is that too often we conflate those concerns with the Chinese Communist Party and leaders in China with Chinese values generally and all of the peoples of China. And so we have an incredibly distorted conversation about our relationship with China, which is kind of lacking context and an appreciation of history, and also an appreciation of the motivations of the Chinese regime, which is not necessarily about global domination, but about regional security and self-preservation. And again, that's not to say that that's not deeply problematic, morally speaking, but it's to understand those motivations and to approach those issues accordingly. And I think, again, what ANZUS does is distort our perceptions. And I would go to what Alex was speaking about threats and the threats that we face, because ANZUS presumes that those threats, like the threat from China, is a military one. And because of that, because it sort of centers military threat above all else, it's structurally unable to deal with threats like climate change or a global pandemic. And so, you know, you see things like when President Biden was elected, I think there was a real wave of hope in Australia for people who want action on climate change, that you know, the election of Biden would really force Australia to change its policies when it came to climate, that it would force Australia to do better. But what we've seen play out, you know, even in that very first meeting that Scott Morrison had with Joe Biden, we see climate really take a back seat to these, you know, higher order issues of security. And so the threat perception that ANZUS gives us, I think, is really distorting and means that, you know, Australia doesn't work with the United States on true global threats like climate change.
Mm. Mark Beeson, to you, how do you see the Chinese threat? I mean, is the Chinese threat, is China the biggest, not existential threat, no one's suggesting that the Chinese are bent on military domination in the region, but do you see China in relation to their influence in the region as being the major threat that that Australia faces?
It depends. Emma's exactly right in suggesting that it depends what you define threats as and how you understand them. I think the, you know, all the sort of reports that the government has issued over the last few years about defence have all acknowledged that the actual threat of direct military confrontation, as far as Australia is concerned, and threats to Australian sovereignty is absolutely minimal and very, very unlikely and difficult to imagine how it could possibly come about. Mm. Now, there are issues about Australia, about China's territorial ambitions in the South China Sea, and they're serious and important. But the reality is that whatever Australia does, if we bought 12 submarines or 20 submarines or 50 submarines, it wouldn't make the slightest difference to China's calculation of their strategic ambitions. If America can't deter Chinese activities, there's nothing Australia can do. And being a supportive chorus in a yet another set of ambitions that have emanated primarily from Washington is not going to really help the situation. And I think Emma's right about the real threats to Australia are entirely about climate change at the moment and the urgency of doing something that simply cannot be overstated, especially in comparison to a very unlikely set of calculations that would involve Australia directly getting involved in a conflict with China, say, over Taiwan. And even if that did unfold, what on earth would Australia be doing in such a conflict?
Would we join with the United States in that, do you think? I mean,
I think almost certainly they'd be first cab off the rank as ever. I think I don't think there's any doubt about that at all, and they'd be supportive of ramping up the pressure on China to stand back or stand down, and that would be a very dangerous set of circumstances to contemplate. Mm. But it's one that is being seriously contemplated and talked about in Canberra at the moment with remarkably sort of blithe unconcern about the possible consequences. Yep. We're literally talking about the possibility of World War III, of course.
Well, yes, in a way, that's right. Alex Tuman, can I put that back to you too? I mean, what is Washington thinking about this? Because some say, look, you know, the Chinese might well decide to launch a strike against Taiwan at some stage in the next decade or so, in which case, how would the Americans respond? How do you think they would?
I think it would ultimately rely on a few of our alliance structures if something like that came to bear. Now, no one wants to see that happen. And I don't think that the ANZUS treaty is reliant on any sort of major conflict like that happening. I just think when you look at the relationship throughout the Indo-Pacific, when it comes to the Quad with India, Japan, Australia, and the U.S., I don't think that those countries want to see China's expansionist efforts continue into areas like Singapore or Taiwan or elsewhere, similar to how they have in Hong Kong.
Mm. They will in Taiwan, though, won't they? I mean, China's made that clear, that they regard Taiwan as part of China and that they see its reunification as inevitable. Now, you know, that inevitability, whether it's pursued militarily or otherwise, they don't view Taiwan as an independent state, do they?
They do not. They refer to it by a different name in Taipei. That's and, right. You know, I mean, that in and of itself shows the difficulty of the cultural belief and the self, you know, of self-determination. I think that the U.S. sees Taiwan as a bit, I wouldn't say a red line, but, you know, there is some sort of line there. And I believe that they would call upon Australia and other alliances throughout the Indo-Pacific to stand up to China should that come to bear.
Emma Scordis, do you think, do you think that that Australia should respond in an instance like that? Because it's not inconceivable that this could occur in the next decade, is it?
No, it's not inconceivable. And I think, you know, I agree with Mark that the really concerning thing is that so many, I think so many elements in Australia, both Australian and politics in the United States are almost kind of gunning for something like this to happen, you know, especially China hawks. You know, my historian's opinion is that any Australian government should be incredibly careful about following the United States into any kind of conflict, because if we look at the history of American military adventurism, you know, it's quite often a strategic and moral disaster. And again, we're seeing that play out in Afghanistan again, and seeing another repeat of history in that there isn't a deep kind of reflection on American power and why it is that American wars end up in the way that they do. And so you can, I think I can certainly conceive of a similar situation arising in a place like Taiwan, especially because there would be huge momentum in the United States towards intervention, as there always is. And the evidence, you know, I agree with Mark that the evidence at the moment suggests that the Australian government would be first out of the blocks to join the United States in such a war. And once again, you know, without asking those really serious strategic questions about what the mission of such a war would be, you know, how would we know when the strategic aims of that war were over? How would we prevent it from reaching the Australian mainland? How would we prevent it from going nuclear? You know, and as Mark said, you know, the cavalier way some of those questions are dismissed by the people who will, you know, at the end of the day, potentially make the decision about whether Australia goes into such a war is really frightening. And so often, you know, they make that decision on the basis of this belief that ANZUS protects Australia in a really unique way, you know, that affords Australia this protection from the United States military umbrella when it just doesn't do that.
Mark Beeson, back to you on has the defeat in Afghanistan, can't be characterised in any other way really, has the defeat in Afghanistan made Australia's situation in the Pacific more precarious, in the sense that, as Joe Biden has underscored, Donald Trump, his predecessor, underscored, America is on the retreat in terms of its involvement in foreign wars and in the maintenance of order in foreign states? Has it made Australia's position in the Pacific more precarious, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, the strategic threat posed by Afghanistan or even terrorism to this country is absolutely minimal and not a justification for going into invading Afghanistan in the first place. So I think we can kind of dismiss that as being a serious kind of consideration. There's a wider question about the reliability of the United States as an ally these days, and people in Europe have been seriously rethinking the value and credibility of American strategic commitments in that context. But I think there's a more important point than getting bogged down in the sort of politics and strategic calculations of the alliance, because most of them are pretty dismal, because the idea of a standoff between the United States and China over Taiwan that could go nuclear, I mean, there are going to be no winners from that kind of thing.
No.
So it seems to me that the challenge is to try and think a bit more creatively before we get into that position. And because in the First World War, alliances were one of the reasons why the First World War happened, despite the fact that nobody actually wanted it to happen or even imagined that it could happen. So it was an absence of foresight and imaginative thinking that got everybody involved in the First World War, which turned out to be the pointless slaughter of millions of people, which is still celebrated in
Australia. Give me an example of that sort of creative thinking that might prevent expansionist attitudes that under President Xi Jinping, China seems to be exhibiting.
Here's one for you, because during the Cold War, surprisingly enough, under Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, both managed to negotiate arms reduction treaties with the Soviet Union, and that surprised everybody. But it also had the benefit, of course, of not spending lots and lots of scarce resources on more and more guns and bombs that can only end in one way if they're ever kind of used. So that was a remarkable achievement in itself. So it's not impossible to imagine that with enlightened leadership in China and the United States, and Alex was saying that rightly that climate change is something that we need cooperation on and we need to work together on. I mean, how about this for a proposition? China and the United States agree to have an arms reduction treaty between themselves, which they would both benefit from because it would wind down the tensions, and it would also save a lot of money, on the condition that they used all the money that they saved to restructure their domestic economies along green, sustainable lines, and they'd be applauded by their domestic populations, I'm sure, and they'd get something out of it themselves. And it's a lot more promising than the kind of dopey groupthink that tends to predominate in Washington, Beijing as well, and indeed in Canberra.
How do you respond to that, Alex?
I think Mark hit the nail on the head. I mean, when you're drawing up, you know, fictional scenarios that are actually could potentially be realistic, that's a wonderful one. And I would implore everyone to read a novel that came out in the past year called 2034 that specifically talks about a potential conflict in the South China Sea, because it's a really interesting way to frame a potential conflict through a fictional narrative for a more broader audience. But just to go back to what Emma was talking about in relation to climate change and carbon emissions, you know, that we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Exactly.
You know, the Biden administration and the Morrison government, you know, they may not agree on every single aspect, but, you know, when it comes to things like climate change, you saw it in the G7 in the United Kingdom. The Biden administration's working with the UK, working with the European Union, working with Japan to urge Australia to cut carbon emissions and reach net zero in a faster timeline. But Americans not all Americans, but many in Washington understand that Australia's economy is very reliant on the export of things like coal and iron ore and natural gas. So we do not, you know, as a people, we do not want to put everyday Australians in a position where they have to choose between carbon emissions and well-paying jobs. I think we need to approach it on a nuanced basis. And this goes back to the treaty, because the relationship between the U.S. and Australia, as I mentioned at the outset, is very deep. There's a bunch of different areas that we work on, whether it's global pandemics or geopolitical power shifts or climate change or economic downturns or cyber attacks. We have to approach each one clear-eyed and figure out what areas that we can work together.
Emma Shortis, how would you reimagine? You say it's not fit for purpose at the moment. How would you reimagine the alliance with the United States, the military alliance at least?
Well, you know, I think Mark has made such an important point about thinking creatively, and Alex has also made a really important point about walking and chewing gum at the same time. You know, we have to be able to approach these issues with the right kind of complexity. In terms of, you know, how we reform the alliance, you know, I'm not sure that I necessarily have the answer to it. And I don't think, you know, individual foreign policy analysts kind of should have the answer. I argue, and I've argued in the book, that part of what reforming our relationship with the United States is going to have to involve is a really deep reckoning with Australia's own history and the morality or lack of in our own foreign policy. And that goes back to our own shared histories in colonialism and dispossession, you know, which neither of our countries have really faced, honestly, and kind of dealt with that legacy. And so creating a genuinely moral relationship, which is focused on building lasting peace and climate action and addressing racial and economic inequality is going to have to take that deep reckoning. And that's really difficult and messy. And, you know, as Mark was suggesting, diplomacy is really hard. And I think what ANZUS does is dramatically oversimplify that extraordinary complexity and lead us to see the world in binary terms. Mm. So it's only when we can move past that mindset that we might be able to build a more moral role for both the relationship and Australia's role in the world.
Mark Beeson, does part of it involve Australia trying to engage more closely in a military sense in terms of equipment and training and all of that with India and Japan? I mean, Alex has mentioned the Quad, which, you know, has been a thing, although depending who you talk to, how important it's become. Do you think it ought to become? Is that the direction, do you think, that Australia ought to be going?
I've got no problem with the Quad in the sense of it promoting cooperation between important countries in the region. Mm. My criticism would be that it's overwhelmingly militaristic in a long-term intention, and that the goal is to contain China. Now, I don't think China can be, quote-unquote, contained easily. I mean, in my view, what we should be thinking about doing is to, because if you've seen from the perspective of Beijing, the Quad looks like an attempt to create an alliance against them. Alliances are always aimed at somebody and aimed to deter somebody else.
But what's wrong with that? What is wrong with that? After all, the Chinese adopt this attitude themselves, don't they?
No, indeed. But the question is, what's the best way to continue engaging China and trying to change its behavior and to make it, to quote Bob Zelick, a responsible stakeholder in the international system? And I think sort of creating a sort of Cold War style alliance of the usual suspects plus India is not the way to encourage good relationships with China. I mean, what they could do for a bit of lateral thinking is actually to invite China to actually join the Quad. That would not only dispel ideas about it being an alliance aimed against them, but it would compel China to engage with the other major powers in the region in a more kind of ongoing, structured, and possibly useful way. And I think there are potential gains from everybody in such a relationship. And clearly, solving the status of Taiwan is going to be a doozy of a problem forever. But it's better to be, you know, jaw-jaw is better than war-war, as Churchill famously said, and that aphorism still holds true.
Mm. Alex Toulmin, just maybe not finally to you, but given even the smallest and mildest criticisms of China from Australia in recent years have been met with some quite significant economic repercussions, China's about waving a big stick these days, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we've referenced the Cold War a few times, and I think, you know, it's an excellent term to, you know, the non-kinetic adversarial relationship that Western democracies are facing with China right now. But we got to realize it's not even in the same ballpark as how the Cold War was. The global economy is so integrated now. In that, you know, a conflict between the U.S. and China would actually negatively impact the entire world economy. Unlike Russia and the U.S. Throughout the Cold War, those economies were virtually cut off from one another in many aspects. So we've got to realize that it is a completely different sort of relationship between the two. One thing I would say is that the Biden administration recently has committed to spending about $1 billion in the Northern Territory on defense in Northern Australia. So I can assure you that from the Biden administration's perspective, they are committed to the security of the Australian people, and they would be behind Australia in any sort of conflict, be it cyber or kinetic.
Mm. Mark, how do you view that investment by the U.S. military in Northern Australia?
I can understand why it appeals to strategic types in Canberra and Washington, because it's feet on the ground and it's bases, not places, and all these kinds of things. But it's a very anachronistic way of thinking that hasn't demonstrated real progress or development over time, I think. And given the nature of the real and tangible threats that we immediately face in a country like Australia in particular, and that's climate change is the biggest problem that we face collectively by a long distance. So the problem is it's opportunity costs. And if we're spending money or even supporting American presence in Australia by helping to build bases or encourage them to come with incentives, then we're not spending that money on something else. And there are plenty of important and worthy causes that such money and savings from military hardware could be spent on in Australia and around the world. And there's one way of improving relations with countries like Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, all the places that have been trashed by Australia and the alliance relationship over the last few decades. Okay. I mean, what about a bit of rebuilding? On, that would do wonders.
We'll have to leave it there. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our panel, Mark Beeson, Professor of International Politics at the University of Western Australia. Thank you, Mark. Emma Shortis, Dr. Shortis is the author of a new book called Our Exceptional Friend, and Alex Toulmin, former advisor to Joe Hockey, the Australian ambassador to the US. Thanks, Alex. And thanks too to Emma.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.